From Washington, this is Daybreak Asia. Good morning, I'm Jim Stevenson. Coming up, China calls for calm after Korea's fire artillery into ocean. Pakistani court indicts Musharraf on treason charges. Australia's prime minister says there's no time limit in the search for the missing Malaysian jet. These stories and more on this Tuesday edition of VOA's Daybreak Asia. North and South Korea traded artillery fire Monday across their disputed western maritime border in the Yellow Sea. And while no casualties were reported, residents on two South Korean border islands were evacuated to shelters as a precaution. North Korea fired artillery shells into South Korean waters following a rare public notification of its intention. Seoul responded by immediately shelling North Korean waters. Officials say no shells hit any land areas on either side and no one was injured. The North in recent weeks has increased threatening rhetoric and conducted a series of rocket and ballistic missile launches off its eastern coast. This North Korea state-controlled newsreader Sunday warned the North may conduct what he calls a new form of nuclear test for bolstering its nuclear deterrence. A statement Sunday from the North's foreign ministry said it was intolerable that the UN Security Council would turn a blind eye to U.S. nuclear war exercises while denouncing the North Korean Army's self-defensive rocket launch exercises. Pyongyang routinely calls military drills between South Korea and the United States a prelude for invasion. But General Paul Kennedy, commander of the 3rd U.S. Marine Expeditionary Brigade, says joint U.S.-South Korean exercises in Pohang, about 360 kilometers off Seoul, have no political objectives.
This exercise was not designed to react to any political situation. It's not designed to send a message. This is something that we have to do to be able to interoperate with our allies.
The Sungyong amphibious exercise involves more than 1,000 South Korean and nearly 10,000 U.S. Marine and Navy personnel. Malcolm Cook, senior analyst at the Singapore-based Institute of Southeast Asian Studies, told VOA's Victor Beatty's artillery exchange is serious, but it's not as serious as the 2010 incidents involving the sinking of the South Korean vessel Chonyun and the loss of 46 South Korean sailors, and the November 2010 shelling of Yeonpyeong Island in which 4 South Koreans were killed.
It was very clear after the 2 episodes in 2010, the sinking of the South Korean corvette and the live North Korean firing on Yeonpyeong Island that at that point hit the island and killed people. The South Korean government was very clear that they wouldn't turn cheek a third time and would respond militarily to any further aggression. The South Korean government had expressed last week worries that the North Korean government would be provocative again, and so again shows that they were correct in the assumption that North Korea and the Kim Jong-un government might do something similar to what happened in 2010.
Is this the first live fire exercise North Korea has engaged in the Yellow Sea since the artillery that killed the 4 people on the South Korean island?
I believe it's the first one since Park Geun-hye came to power, the new South Korean leader who's focusing on trying to reestablish more cooperative relations with North Korea under what she calls trust politics. And it's probably a key point, a little bit tangential. The North Koreans have never recognized the maritime border between North and South Korea or South Korea's claim to Yeonpyeong Island. So for the North Koreans, they wouldn't see that they've intervened into South Korean territory because they don't recognize South Korea's claim to that part of the Yellow Sea.
North Korea has threatened to carry out what it called a new form of nuclear test. Last Wednesday, it test-fired 2 mid-range ballistic missiles capable of striking Japan. Do you see a change in North Korean behavior?
Yeah, it's probably a change in the short term, but North Korea, under its previous leadership from the Kim family, has a long history of this kind of dual-track diplomacy, if you want to call that, of offering some olive branches like family reunions or bilateral summits with South Korea, and then often in very quick succession, carrying out missile tests or live fire exercises.
When they refer to a nuclear test, a new form, could they possibly mean a warhead that's small enough to fit on a missile?
If they were able to show that they've been able to miniaturize a nuclear warhead to put on any of their short, medium, or long-range missiles, then that would be a significant change.
The North has conducted three nuclear tests, the most recent in February last year. South Korea's foreign minister warned that the North would pay a severe cost if it went ahead with another nuclear test in defiance of UN Security Council sanctions. China, meanwhile, has called for calm in the Korean Peninsula after North Korea fired artillery near South's maritime border and Seoul fired back about 300 shells. Rebecca Valley has more from Hong Kong for VOA.
South Korea's Defense Ministry spokesman Kim Min-seok said Pyongyang notified Seoul of its plans to conduct live fire drills and then fired shells in waters that belong to South Korea. Kim said the action was a planned provocation by the North, aimed at testing the South's willingness to protect its water boundaries. Kim added that the South intended to firmly punish North Korea for the infraction and has responded by firing about 300 shells. As a precaution, South Korean authorities moved residents of the nearby islands into shelters. The firing lasted hours and happened in water close to North Korea's western shores, where the boundaries between the two countries are contested. North Korea does not recognize the northern limit line, which was drawn in the 50s and includes a number of islands physically closer to North Korea that are designated as South Korean territory. North Korea's sole ally in the region, China, called for calm and restraint. Foreign Ministry spokesman Hong Lei addressed reporters in Beijing. He says the temperature is rising on the Korean Peninsula, and this worries Beijing. He calls on all sides to remain calm and not do anything to worsen tension. Beijing has repeatedly stated its concern about spikes in tensions that could endanger stability in the region. It traditionally sides with the United Nations in condemning provocative acts by the North, including the launch of missiles and developments in Pyongyang's nuclear weapon program. But Beijing has fallen short of singling out the North and says all parties involved have a responsibility to tone down their action. Cheng Xiaohe, a professor of international relations at Renmin University in Beijing, says that in incidents such as Monday's exchange of fire, there is not much China can do. He says the actions are not directly targeting China, but might hamper something that China has pushed for a long time, the resumption of the six-party talks. The talks are a series of multilateral negotiations that stalled in 2009, after North Korea had already agreed to abandon its nuclear program in exchange for aid and security guarantees. Apart from the two Koreas, China, the U.S. and Russia, the six-party talks also includes Japan. On Monday, officials from Japan and North Korea wrapped up their first government-level meeting in more than a year. The talks were held in China and mostly focused on the handling of Japanese nationals kidnapped by the North in the 70s and in the 80s. Rebecca Valley in Hong Kong for VOA.
Before the firing began between the Koreas, we began asking this week's poll question. North Korea claims that its recent missile tests were a response to the joint military exercises being carried out by South Korea and the United States. Should the United States limit its military exercises with South Korea to reduce the tensions between the Koreas? So far, everyone responding has an opinion, with 0% choosing unsure. 31 say yes, the United States should reduce the amount of military exercises it conducts with South Korea. Almost 24% say no, the United States should conduct the same amount of military exercises. And the majority, as of today, 45% say the United States should increase the number of exercises it conducts with South Korea. You can register your opinion at our program page, voanews.com/Daybreak Asia, or visit us on Facebook, where you can be sure to like us. A special court in Pakistan Monday indicted former military ruler Pervez Musharraf on 5 counts of high treason. The trial is being held as unprecedented in a country where the powerful military has staged three coups and its officers until now have enjoyed de facto immunity from prosecution in civilian courts. Ayaz Gul reports from Islamabad.
The former military chief and president Pervez Musharraf appeared before a three-member panel of judges amid tight security and pleaded not guilty to all charges against him. This was only his second court appearance since the legal proceedings began 3 months ago. Mr. Musharraf has mostly remained under treatment in a military hospital near Islamabad. Defense attorneys have cited either security or health reasons for his previous absences, while critics have accused him of engaging in delaying tactics to obstruct the court. Prosecution attorney Sardar Asmatullah spoke to reporters following Monday's proceedings.
He appeared before the court today. The formal charges were framed against him, and he denied the charges. He stated that he doesn't plead the guilty.
During the hearing, Mr. Musharraf declared he is not a traitor and highlighted the achievements he said Pakistan made during his nearly decade-long rule. The former president reiterated that he is prepared to face trial and defend his actions that he says were approved by the Prime Minister and Cabinet at the time. Observers, however, say the indictment of the former general on charges of treason marks a milestone for Pakistan's political and legal history. Sam Zarifi is Asia Director for the International Commission of Jurists, or ICJ.
It's unprecedented, obviously, to begin to seek some accountability, to hold to justice anybody at such a senior level in the military. So potentially it's a very significant step forward. And of course, a lot now depends on how the trial itself proceeds.
Zarifi says this is an opportunity for Pakistan's judiciary to demonstrate that no one is above the law and that it must ensure the trial fully complies with international standards.
So this is a step forward for the courts in that sense too, also to show exactly what a proper trial looks like and what kind of processes a defendant is entitled.
Mr. Musharraf seized power in a military coup in 1999 by ousting then Prime Minister Nawaz Sharif. The high treason charges against Mr. Musharraf stem from 2007, when he imposed a state of emergency in Pakistan, suspended the constitution, and unlawfully removed top judges to quash opposition. If convicted, he could face the death penalty. Ayaz Gul for VOA News, Islamabad.
A very big crowd, more than 100,000 people, packed the streets outside Taiwan's presidential office Sunday to call for scrapping a trade agreement with China. But the mostly younger protesters were less worried about doing business with powerful political rival Beijing than they are fed up with the ways and the deals that are made at home. Ralph Jennings reports for VOA from Taipei on the new demands of Taiwan's spiraling protest movement.
Protesters estimated between 100,000 and 400,000 packed boulevards and metro stations in central Taipei Sunday, wearing black shirts as a symbol of what they call poor transparency. They demanded that their president scrap a pact with China to liberalize investment in each other's service sectors. Some demonstrators fear Beijing will leverage the pact to push self-rule Taiwan into uniting with China as a single country. China has seen Taiwan as its own since the Chinese Civil War of the 1940s. But most are angry that President Ma Ying-jeou's government signed the agreement in June without telling people more about it. Protester Mai Bo-jun, a 28-year-old night school student from northern Taiwan, does not understand what's in the agreement. He says he does not oppose the proposed trade pact, but that the problem is the government passed it before saying clearly what's inside. He says that has caused young people not to know what lies ahead in their future. He hopes the government can clearly tell the public about every element of the pact instead of just saying at news conferences that it's great. Sunday's protest follows from an occupation of parliament since March 18. Hundreds of students first blocked the podium to make legislators ratify the trade pact item by item rather than as a package. Now they want it thrown out and renegotiated. Previous protests in Taiwan against China tie-ups have focused on perceived political threats from Beijing. But 20 deals signed under President Ma to date have lifted Taiwan's trade, tourism, and investment for local business people while creating an estimated 9,600 local jobs. Officials say the agreement contested today will lift Taiwan's service sector, which is 69% of the economy. Taiwan's president has made an international name since 2008 for breaking 60 years of icy relations with China to reach the first economic, trade, and investment agreements between the two countries. Protesters now want more public review before agreements are signed, often in China, and after private meetings between the two sides' ruling parties. Ralph Jennings, VOA News, Taipei.
Australia's Prime Minister Tony Abbott, whose country is taking a lead role to find the missing Malaysian jet, says he has set no time limit on the search for the aircraft. As Ron Corbin reports from Bangkok, officials said debris spotted Sunday that was considered to be a promising lead instead turned out to be fishing equipment.
In recent weeks, satellites and spotter planes have located hundreds of pieces of debris that investigators have hoped could be traced to flight MH370. But so far, they have not found any debris or objects from the missing plane. On Monday, a flotilla of 11 ships, including 7 from China and 10 aircraft, scoured a 254,000 square kilometre area of the Indian Ocean. The searches reported several more objects identified as promising leads. Despite the frustrations, Australia's Prime Minister Tony Abbott, speaking in Perth Monday, said there was no immediate time limit on efforts to find the plane.
I'm certainly not putting a time limit on it. I think, as I said, we owe it to the families. We owe it to everyone who travels by air. We owe it to the governments of the countries who had citizens on that aircraft. We owe it to the wider world, which has been transfixed by this mystery for 3 weeks now. We owe it to everyone to do whatever we reasonably can, and we can keep searching for quite some time to come.
Mr. Abbott said the intensity of the operations was increasing, despite challenges and the magnitude of operations of what he termed an extraordinarily difficult exercise. Malaysian Defence Minister Hishamuddin Hussein said Monday he is travelling to Hawaii this week to meet with the US Defence Secretary and discuss the search effort. He will also speak with fellow ASEAN defence ministers while in Honolulu. Malaysian authorities say they are working with Australia to create a new joint agency coordination centre, headed by a retired Australian Air Chief Marshal, that will coordinate the international search effort out of Pearce Air Force Base in Perth, Western Australia. A ship carrying a specialised black box locator is due to arrive in the search area on Thursday. Investigators hope that if they can get the device within range of the aircraft's flight recorder, it will be able to detect the signal and searchers will be able to locate the main wreckage of the aircraft. 26 nations are involved searching for Malaysian flight MH370 that disappeared off radar on March 8 while bound for Beijing with 239 passengers and crew on board. The majority of those on the plane, 154, are Chinese nationals. Family members of the Chinese nationals on board the Boeing 777 have strongly protested Malaysia's handling of the situation. Ron Corbin for VOA News, Bangkok, Thailand.
Our weekly series, Women Rising, opens today with a saying: a lot of problems in the world would disappear if we talk to each other. That's been one approach taken to solve the problem of female genital mutilation in Asia. According to the World Health Organization, female genital mutilation, or FGM, involves all procedures that involve partial or total removal of the external female genitalia or other injury to the female genital organs for non-medical reasons. It's carried out for what are considered traditional reasons in many communities. However, FGM is internationally recognized as a violation of the human rights of girls and women. It is nearly always carried out on minors and is considered a violation of the rights of children. Claudia Kappa, statistics specialist with UNICEF, tells Daybreak Asia's Francis Alonso that ending the practice can be as simple as having couples, families, and communities talk to each other about it.
We have evidence that the practice exists, at least in Indonesia and Malaysia. It's not done as a national practice, if you would, but given the size of the population of women living in this country, we are still talking about a large number of girls and women. For these countries, however, we do not have representative data.
Why is that?
It's only very recently that data collection on this traditional harmful practice has been collected. there has not been such a demand, if you want, for data.
Wouldn't this come to light in childbirth?
Of course, this is a crucial moment in a woman's life when those affected by the cutting, specifically the most invasive forms, this is when it becomes particularly difficult for women to deliver.
What comes to mind is female genital mutilation versus male circumcision. How do they differ and how are they similar?
They are extremely different. Female genital mutilation is clearly an indication of oppression against girls and women. It was conceived, it started as a tradition, as a form of clearly discriminatory practice against women and girls. It's related to their sexuality. It's a form of control. And in the majority of countries for which we have data, the majority of men and women are against the continuation of the practice. The practice continue because of social pressure. Particularly women, they feel obliged to conform to what is seen as a tradition. They think that this is what is expected from the society and the communities where they live, from their husbands, from their religious leaders. So we need to make sure that we promote dialogue. We make sure that the opposing attitudes versus the practice are brought to light. We have to facilitate this dialogue between husbands and wives, across generations and in the communities where the practice takes place, because we want to shift, in a way, the social norm that keep the practice in place.
But how do you talk about such a sensitive subject within a marriage and respect that marriage and those decisions? I mean, it could come across as meddling, could it not?
Of course. That's why having a very sensitive approach to the promotion of this dialogue is very important. UNICEF also is very careful in the terminology we use with respect to the practice. We talk about empowering families and community for the gradual abandonment of the practice of female genital mutilation. Again, women and men do not necessarily talk. And in a country like Egypt, we have data that confirm that women tend to underestimate the proportion of boys and men who are against the practice. They think men want it. And in some cases, they do. But in others, men are against the practice. The problem is that women do not know, and there is no dialogue. It's considered a women thing. So women don't necessarily ask men's opinion, and men don't necessarily feel empowered to have a say.
It sounds like a strange statement coming from you, saying that men don't feel empowered to talk about it.
Because this is a woman thing. As many others, the care of the house, the care of the children, it's a woman issue. So men don't feel like they have a say or they can interfere. They don't necessarily feel like they want to change the course of a practice that has been in existence, but they may still be against. And many women are also against. The problem is they feel they are the only ones against, or they don't feel like they can speak up.
Claudia Kappa, a statistics specialist with UNICEF, speaking with Daybreak Asia's Francis Alonzo, who presents a new edition of Women Rising each week at this time right here on Daybreak Asia. And be sure to stop by our Facebook page. You'll see Francis's stories and a lot more. And you can like us there as well, as over 100,000 of our friends have. One of our friends is Steve Norman. He's going to bring you the latest world news next on International Edition. I'm Jim Stevenson. Thanks for joining us today on Daybreak Asia.
If you doubt the speed at which the world is changing, just take a look at the digital media. In the last 20 years, the introduction of mobile and internet technology has spawned breathtaking advances in the sharing of information and commerce. Today, an estimated 1/4 of the Earth's population uses the services of the internet. 2/3 of us now own a mobile phone. But these advances into the digital age have been met with problems. Problems like state censorship, hackers, and identity theft, to name just a few. The Voice of America wants to know how the digital world has transformed your life. Or have they? We'd like you to tell us your story by writing or sending videos to our website,